You're listening to IsraelScene.com. And you're listening to IsraelScene.com. Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself.
And you're on.
Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
I wanted to ask you about your Jewish Zionist biography, which is a very interesting and a very classic one, although it's no longer the biography of many of the people who, many of the American Jews who come here. And you came of age at the time of World War II, I understand.
Very briefly, I was born in Philadelphia in 1920. At the age of six, I went with my family. We moved to Atlantic City. I grew up there, came back to Philadelphia for my university training at Temple University. A month after graduation, I was drafted and spent 3 years in the American Army, including one in the Philippines. And then when I left the Army, I joined the Jewish Theological Seminary as a student. And I was in the middle of the course, uncertain as to whether I wanted to go on to be a conservative rabbi. So I decided I would take advantage of a special one-year course that the Hebrew University was offering for overseas students. And I decided in Jerusalem, where I'd be studying Jewish studies, whether I wanted to go on in the course of the rabbinate. A month after I arrived, and I came in October, the UN decided on its partition decision. And then the riots began, the shootings, the killings. And I joined the Haganah. They assumed that I was a seasoned veteran, but I had actually been with the Information Education Division in the American Army. But they threw a machine gun at me, and they taught me how to use it. And I was with an infantry brigade at a time when the Arabs had cut off the road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, where the British were pounding this city for 2 months, causing hundreds of casualties. At a time when there was no talk about humanitarian aid, because not one ounce of food or not one item of bread came into the city. Worst of all, and here I speak about British hypocrisy, who are blaming us for this so-called inhuman naval blockade around Gaza. I remember the British for years kept up an inhuman, heinous naval blockade of Palestine from millions of Jews who were desperately trying to get out of the Nazi butchery in Europe and reach Palestine. They should be the last ones to criticize us. And I think it's a pure hypocrisy on the part of their government, their trade unions, their churches, their academics, to try to label us for a crime which was far worse than that they did. At any rate, the Arabs cut the road to Mount Scopus, where I was studying. After the third bombing, the first one was on Ben Yehuda Street. The second one was at the Jewish Agency. And the third was the Palestine Post. That day, I joined the Haganah, fought with the Moria Battalion, the Etzioni Brigade, until the end of the war in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, I had met a very pretty Sabra, and we fell in love. And after the war was over in Jerusalem, we took the Burma Road to get to Tel Aviv. Our parents were in mourning because their son had died with the Palmach at an attack at Nebi Yusha in the Galilee. It's a very sober affair. And then I taught for a year. My wife had just finished the university with an MA in literature, and she wanted to go for her doctorate, so we packed up and went to New York for 6 years, where I worked with the Consulate General, helping with their PR work. We came back in 1959, I think. I decided I was going to open up a public relations office, so I scoured the city to find a proper site. We went to Jerusalem, and I found an old crumbling wreck, which is now occupied by by the mall on Rehov Melech George. It had been a Syrian-owned building, and after the War of 1848, it had been taken over. It was falling to pieces, but I went through it, dark, deserted, but I found a lovely room, and I opened up the office. It was a pretty thriving business. And then in 1990, I got a call from New York from someone I didn't know. Introduced himself as, my name is Brown. I'm from the Mutual Broadcasting System. We're looking for a correspondent in Jerusalem. Would you be interested? Mutual, at that time, its flagship station was WOR in New York, had 900 stations throughout America and Canada. So I took the job and began broadcasting. A month later, another call from New York. We are the Westinghouse Group. We are looking for a correspondent in Jerusalem. Will you be interested? Yes, I'd be interested. A month later, AP and UP called me from New York saying, we are making our transition from print coverage to also include radio coverage. So for about 6 months, I was broadcasting for four competing networks, scared to death after each broadcast that I was going to give the wrong sign off. But I was rolling in dollars. And my friends were all academics earning peanuts, and they were all spouting their ideas, and here I had a tremendous audience. At any rate, that continued. My first big coverage was the Eichmann trial. The Eichmann trial, Florida. It was held in the Beit Ha'am public building, and I sat almost as close to Eichmann, who was in a glass cage, as you're sitting opposite me. And I heard witness after witness testify to what they had gone through in the ghettos, in the camps. One man by the name of Kotsetnik collapsed at my feet. I couldn't take it from time to time, and I had to run out into the courtyard. See if the sun were still shining. How the world could have stood by passively and watched 6 million men, women, and children slaughtered, and nobody willing to take them in. Well, I continued covering every day, and then my biggest scoop of all was the outbreak of the Six-Day War. On May 15th, 1967, Nasser had closed the Straits of Tehran, blocking all shipping to and from Eilat. It was a casus belli. And everybody knew that a war was coming. And then he recalled his troops from Yemen, Dafka, where he had fought a losing war, and instead of bringing him back to Egypt, which would be a shameful episode, he sent him into Sinai. And there he dismissed the UN Corps, which was stationed along the border. And everyone knew that a war was inevitable. Called my company, I said, look, a war is coming. You've got to send somebody over here to help me. So they sent there, and we decided that if war were to break out, he would go with the troops for the first week and would telephone me, and I'd be the anchor in Jerusalem and pass on the word. And then we would change, and he'd come to Jerusalem, and I'd go out with the troops. Well, his contribution to helping me cover the war when the war broke out was to pile into a taxi with four other foreign correspondents and accompanied the troops leading the way into Gaza. They came to a barrier in the road made up of stones. They piled out of the taxi to clear the barrier. Under the last stone was a large mine, which sent my friend to the hospital where I was left alone to cover the war. And my friend, the Canadian correspondent, was killed. At any rate, all I could do after the war broke out, and the war broke out on June 5th, 1967, at 10 o'clock, when the Jordanians, without any explanation or provocation, began bombing the city. So all I could do was stay in Jerusalem listening to the reports transferred to me by the other correspondents by the military censor, scoot 100 meters to the major post office. Our office was in the Russian compound with the censor, and broadcast whatever the censor gave us. On the second day of the fighting, after I had finished my last broadcast, I got into my car in a blacked-out city, in a blacked-out car. I was more afraid of the traffic than I was of the incoming shells. And I was going to go home. And then I see a beam of light coming from a source and playing among the Jordanian positions. And I was entranced. It was a blacked-out city. So I drove to the source of this light, and it was on top of the Histadrut building on Strauss Street. And I climbed up to the roof, and there were half a dozen army officers with a large searchlight pinpointing the targets to our planes over above. And I stood there entranced, and they said, if you want to see the end of the war in Jerusalem, come back tomorrow morning at 7. Tomorrow morning, the next day, I was there at 7 with my tape recorder. And the view was immense. At that time, there were no other buildings, and I had a magnificent view of the battlefield stretching from Mount Scopus all the way over to the old city. Below, Gur and his paratroopers were fighting their way from post to post, and he was in constant walkie-talkie with us and probably any number of army outposts listening in. And the battle went according to plan. I was amazed. He said, we're going to pound them for about an hour to soften them up, and then we're going to have our Air Force attack the Augusta Victoria Hospital, which was the Arab last stronghold. And we're going to repeat that at 9:20. At 9 o'clock, 8 voteurs appeared, covered the area with napalm. 9:20, they were back. And I was fascinated, and I remember that a correspondent usually covering a war is either with a unit at the front where he gets a worm's eye view of what's going on, very limited idea, or he's with the generals at the rear and he can't see anything at all. And here I was watching this battle progress in walkie-talkie contact with Gur. And at 9:50, Gur told us, we're going in. And the commander next to me shouted, they'll be going in through the Lion's Gate. At 10 o'clock, we got word from Gur, Har Habayit Biadenu. Well, we all cried. And I was wrapping up my gear to rush back with the scoop to the sensors off. The walkie-talkie came to life again from some remote patrol somewhere in Sinai. We've just reached the Suez Canal. Wow! Back to the sensor calls Tel Aviv. Can Wortman say this? Yes. A half hour after Gur's announcement, I was on the air broadcasting the last 10 minutes that I had recorded of the battle. And I walked away elated on cloud nine. I remembered the guys that had fallen in 48. And here I marveled that I had been a herald to the world that the dreams of 100 generations had just come true.
A month or so ago, published in the Jerusalem Post as a paid advertisement, a series of questions. I think there were 43 of them. And I was wondering if any one of the questions was something you would particularly like to explore with us.
There's one that's very much in the news today. Two words, Gilad Shalit. My question was, how can we get Shalit free? No one has come up with an answer, but I think I have a possible answer. And this is it, very briefly. Gilad Shalit is being kept in a damp, dark cellar, unable to be visited even by the International Red Cross, living in terrible conditions. We have 7,000 Arab terrorists who have been captured and who are in our prisons. They are living in comfortable headquarters. They have a stroll several times a day in a courtyard, open courtyard. They have television. They even have family visits. And I was figuring, how are we going to get Shalit out of it? And my suggestion is this. We take these 7,000 terrorists, put them in the same conditions that Shalit is living in, and then settle back and wait for the response. The response is going to come from the 7,000 families in Gaza and the West Bank whose sons are living in these intolerable conditions. There's already unrest in Gaza about the living conditions. But when the 7,000 families see that their sons are living in these horrible conditions, there's going to go up a terrible cry, supported by a large number of Gazans. Get our sons at all cost out of these conditions. Free Shalit if necessary, but get them out. I have heard no other way from anybody. I think this might do the trick. But how to persuade the government, which says that we're a civilized society, we never descend to the depths of our enemies. Sometimes too much democracy can destroy democracy, as witnessed what happened to the Weimar Republic. And our breastfeeders today, including, for example, academics working in Israeli universities, drawing their salaries from the public, calling for a boycott on Israel, telling the world that they should have nothing to do with this brutal, barbaric state. This is simply destroying democracy, using democracy to destroy democracy.
The question that interested me, and I think it was question number one, is you asked who is making policy here. Is it Netanyahu or Obama?
And
the small coalition parties. And one of the questions that you didn't ask, which I thought was the question that we as a community really need to confront, is the question not so much of who's making the policy as much as what should the policy be. Now, the issue that Obama and Netanyahu were clashing over was the issue of continued building in the settlements, the continued expansion of the Israeli civilian presence in the West Bank and even in East Jerusalem. And to that question, excuse me, and I'm curious as to how you relate to that question.
I think we've already taken a stand on the so-called territories. We have decided that there are going to be three major blocks within those territories on the West Bank. It's going to be Ariel, Kedumim, and the third one in the north. At any rate, we have said in advance that those three areas are going to come under the jurisdiction of Israel. And we have said we are not going to permit unauthorized building outside of those areas, but we will allow enough space to those areas so that there will be room for natural growth. The Arabs today are demanding preconditions. You have to accept the refugees back. You have to fall back to the 1967 lines, which Abba even described as the Auschwitz borders. You have to make a compensation. We have yet to recognize you as a viable democratic Jewish state. And Netanyahu now is faced with a problem. Is he going to accept these preconditions? He says, no, we are going to have direct talks with the Arabs. Everything is going to be on the table. America, particularly Obama, is pushing both sides hard, pushing us a little harder than he's pushing the Palestinians to sit down and have these direct talks. We are willing. The Palestinians are not. And how one is going to clear the atmosphere so that both sides will sit down, no preconditions is still beyond me.
One of the other questions, and I think it was sort of the main subtext of your paid advertisement, is why is this a paid advertisement, and why does the Jerusalem Post not just print your comments as op-eds, I assume, is what you were referring to. And I'm wondering if you have an answer to that or a personal experience there.
My family was a good friend of Agron, then Agronsky, in Philadelphia. And then Agronsky went to serve in the Jewish Legion in World War I and later settled in Palestine. And he later founded what was called the Palestine Post, which eventually after liberation became the Jerusalem Post. I came to Palestine in 1947, looked up Agron. I was a student, and he said, Eliezer, why don't you contribute from time to time? And I began writing for the Palestine Post, and then I continued, and I've written literally scores and scores of articles, and never a penny asked, never a penny given. I once had the temerity to ask for a free subscription. No money. Well, to make a long story short, Vayakam Paro Chadash Lo Hikir Et Yosef. And I'm putting this on the record. I ran afoul of Horowitz, David Horowitz, the editor. We had a bitter personal spat. And then he informed me that any time I submitted an article, he was going to send it on, presumably unread, to the op-ed editor. And I cannot prove this, but I can only sense it, along with the suggestion that the article not be printed. When this happened over a number of times, and I was exploding inside, wanting to get out these thoughts, I decided I'd go for a paid ad. And I've now taken out 8 paid ads. And the last paid ad, which dealt with reaping the whirlwind, which I castigated the American major Jewish organizations for not fighting for religious freedom in Israel and giving support to the conservative and reform and reconstructionist people living here. Before that, the ad with the 80. But in the last ad, I also added, this is my 8th paid ad. Why? Ask the Post. That headlined the article. And, of course, Horowitz struck it out. But if you want to know why I'm using paid ads, it's cheaper in the long run. Because if I didn't get this out of me through some expression publicly, I'd explode and have to go to a psychiatrist and pay more. But since the last time they raised the price of the ads, I'm not going to put in any more paid ads. By the way, I will admit that I'm somewhat disappointed at the lack of response to the ads that I put in.
Well,
the country is an uproar. It's always split the government. There is no one single party running the government because of our electoral system, which is based on proportional representation. No one party has ever succeeded in getting a majority in the Knesset. Each party gets representation according to the percentage of the vote it gets. And so we have about 20 parties with no one with an absolute majority, forcing the party with the largest number of representatives to turn to smaller parties to join them in order to get control of the Knesset. These small parties have their own demands, demands for money, demands for power, which the major power, major party, gives into them for fear of losing the coalition. And therefore, I say that is the root of most of the problems here in Israel. What we have to do is change the electoral system to a constituent system, like there is in America and in England, where the country is divided up into voting districts, and the winner in that voting district takes all of the votes, which has resulted in America with a two-party system, one party able to rule, the other party able, if they're dissatisfied and can whip up enough public support, able to replace them at the next election. This is impossible in Israel. Why? Because it's a catch-22 situation. In order to get this bill through, this reform bill, you have to get it through the Knesset. And the Knesset members are the last ones who are going to vote themselves out of office. This is not something that the Arabs sprung on us. This is something that started with the beginning of the state. How we are going to get out of this mess, I really don't know. All I can say is that the next government is going to be even worse than this one.
I'm tempted to say that on that happy note, but I usually am sarcastic, but it's such a sad story that I will just, again, thank you for your time, Mr. Wartman. There are a few of us who have the perspective that you bring to the issues that we deal with, and I thoroughly agree with you that the electoral system here is a foundation of our inability to really govern well and govern wisely. And I again thank you, and hopefully, if not as a paid advertisement, hope to come across your writings and your thoughts in just about any other form that they happen to arrive.
Excited.